The following podcast is produced for the workshop Chinese Objects Outside of China, which took place at the Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library from June 5th to June 9th, 2017. The workshop is part of the Chinese Object Study Workshops program administered by the Smithsonian's Museums of Asian Art, the Freer Gallery of Art, and the Arthur M. Sackler Gallery, sponsored by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Imagine that you encountered these two teapots together in a museum display, or better, in someone's china cabinet or on a store shelf. It wouldn't take much looking to notice some similarities between these objects. Perhaps your eye is drawn first to their identically rounded bellies, angled spouts, and paunchy lids with tapering acorn-shaped finials. If you pick them up and turn them around a bit in your hands, you notice that they're the same size, weight, and general design, but with just enough minute variation to inspire suspicion that they were handmade. The similarities apparently stop there, between a flamboyantly polychromatic teapot and a more subdued blue and white one, but there is a more profound likeness linking these two. If your eye sifts through the chipped gold and faded orange-red on the multicolored teapot, you will see a central motif of a bird perched on a rock with bursts of peonies to either side. This design, rendered in cobalt blues infused to the glaze, directly corresponds to the design at the center of the blue and white teapot. And we can count even more twins, the leafy sprig running up both handles, the curved plumes framing both spouts, the diamond pattern banding the shoulders and lids, and, most delicately of all, the double line encircling the finials. All this is to say that when these two teapots came out of the kiln, for the first time, they were of an identical make and design. They differ now because one was spruced up at a later point. What might lead to the cohabitation of these two teapots today in a museum's collection? Teapots that, on one hand, tell us so much about the popularity of standardized porcelain wares, and on the other hand, demonstrate an extreme desire for their differentiation. These are the questions at the center of the following podcast about what we can tell from these two little household objects. We can tell much about the changing taste for porcelain at the place of their manufacture compared to the place of their sale and resale and use, about the mass appeal and culture of tea and its associated objects, and even particular coincidences in the development of decorating techniques around the world. There is also much we do not and cannot factually know. If you look at the museum records for these teapots, or those of their siblings in museum collections around the world, you will notice that given date ranges are approximate and that artists' or makers' names rarely appear. There are often inexplicable gaps between when and where the object was created and the next record in its provenance. But the knowable and the verifiable are equally central to how we tell the story of these two objects. These are actually traits of this object type, namely the Chinese export porcelain. Chinese export porcelain is a term that recognizes the ceramics produced explicitly for international sale, frequently from the southern Chinese town of Jingdezhen. The elaborate construction process of a single teapot, ironically, obscures the identity of individual makers or particular dates of creation. For example, the clay of the pot-bellied body, the lid, the spout, all need to be thrown separately on a potter's wheel, and then the handle hand-pulled before everything gets trimmed and assembled. As Chinese export porcelains were only fired once for reasons, including the economical, the clay body had to dry before decorations in cobalt blue were brushed on. Only then was the whole teapot and lid dipped in clear glassy glaze and fired in the kiln. The mere list of these steps already illustrates the need for a spacious workshop and many craftsmen working together. A single maker's name, or the precise moment or year an object is considered complete, are grains of information lost to time. And for every such teapot documented in a museum collection, there are exponentially more that have not survived the test of use, and that lay buried somewhere in shipwrecks or cupboards around the world. The very incidence that two teapots of the same make and design reside in Winterthur's collection is evidence of the scale of mass production. And while we have difficulty pinpointing the precise date of these teapots' manufacture or sale, we have clues about their broader historical context. In fact, our clue comes in the form of the slightest detail on both vessels, the thin purple-brown line encircling the rim of their lids. This is called a false unglazed rim because it was fashioned after Han Dynasty practices of finishing distinguished luxury vessels with metal to set them apart. The clay edge beneath this metal would have been left unglazed, and so the fashion for the false rim in China, a retro accent, reached peak popularity in export porcelain during the late Ming and early Qing dynasties. This thin brown line thus allows us to make an educated guess that these teapots were produced during the mid-17th through early 18th centuries. We are, of course, also aided by historical record. We know from ships' logs and vendor inventories that in the 17th century, during the Ming Dynasty, Chinese export porcelains experienced a market boom. As naval European nations established direct trade with China, merchants had access to greater volumes of Chinese trade objects. Previously, porcelains were made on commissioned luxury goods for the very wealthy of each society. After the turn of the 17th century, there was enough stock to be sold off affordably on a popular market. And as a result of this new kind of demand, artisans at Jingdezhen began to generalize motifs for mass appeal and standardize rendering for efficient production. One might think of peonies or birds on rocks as templates in this process. In fact, some objects even betray the extent to which the design process became perhaps even rushed and wrote. Compare the motifs to the left of the spout on both teapots. The bird on the blue and white vessel appears to have been drawn more hurriedly and broadly compared to the fine and measured contours of its compatriot on the polychromatic teapot. The blue bird's extreme angularity seems to be the product of formulaic drawing rather than attention to the particular logic of a single representation of a bird. Its surrounding rock and peonies, too, have been greatly simplified for efficiency. It would be reasonable to guess that the blue and white teapot was made later than the colorful one, made in a more urgent moment. This leads to the question of why someone would want to sell or buy a teapot in which its ostensibly lucrative and popular design is covered up with other decoration, especially decoration that is mostly unrelated to the blue underglaze. The best we can do is propose a few explanations for the twice-decorated teapot until new and better scholarship becomes available. And in order to do this, we must first understand more about the process and the material added to the teapot, because this will give us a sense of its technical demands, cost, and visual potential. And you can tell a surprising amount from simply inspecting the teapot, as a sharp-eyed customer might have done centuries ago. You can notice that there are some fields of richly pigmented, opaque color, such as the green starburst leaves, the white flower petals, and the liberally applied iron red. There's also the more diaphanous, semi-transparent salmon orange and the flower band. And of course, the gold, though its shine has become more subdued with time. The first two pigmented kinds of decoration are enamel, which are derived from metallic oxides, while the gold is applied through a gilding process, are grouped together as what is called overglaze decoration, meaning that they were applied after the glaze was fired and so sit on top of it. In the last decades of the 17th century, both in China and throughout Europe, advances in porcelain enameling technologies, and particularly the use of opaque enamels, allowed craftsmen to experiment with unprecedented color palettes. And the novelty quickly became fashionable. Because the properties of opaque enamel allow mixing and layering, one could theoretically achieve a broad range of colors. And yet, the enamels on this teapot have a restrained palette of predominantly iron red, green, gold, with touches of white and black. The reason for this might have been the economy afforded by using a limited palette, but fashionability might also provide us a cause. In the fraught transition between the Ming and Qing dynasties in the middle of the 17th century, The workshops of Jing Dejen halted production between 1656 and 1684. To satisfy unabated demands for export porcelain, European merchants turned to Japan, and particularly the town of Arita. The export porcelains produced there are conventionally known as imari wares. Imari is conventionally associated with a color palette of underglazed blue, overglazed red enamel, and gilded gold, and occasionally some other colors. Imari is often associated with a distinctive color palette of underglazed blue, overglazed red enamel, and gilded gold, though occasionally other colors appear. These porcelains became so popular among European consumers that when Jing Dejen reopened during the Qing Dynasty, workshops adapted a Chinese version of imari, using blue, red, and gold palettes as well. While our enameled and gilded teapot might be a product of this trend, there is reason to suspect that it did not receive its overglazed decorations in China. Thinking back on that multi-step production process, we remember that teapots demand a complex coordination and planning system. Since enamel and gold were applied after the first firing, in which the clay body underglazed blue and glass glaze fused together, the craftsman responsible for the blue decoration would have anticipated overglaze additions by leaving blank spaces for it. This saved on the cost of raw materials and eliminated visual redundancy. Our teapot, however, does not convince that the underglaze decorator coordinated with the overglaze decorator. Dark underglaze contours of bird and flower are repeated in red and gold. The pale blue leaves are repainted in green. And the lunette and daisy band on the top even crop some of the underglaze motifs. This would have been a wastefully expensive way of producing a teapot by Jing Dejen standards. What's more, the blue and white teapot, which bears not a trace of enamel and gilt, tells us that this particular make of teapot was conceived in Jing Dejen as market-ready, without additional overglaze decoration. This points us to the likely possibility that the polychromatic teapot received its second round of decorations upon its entry in Europe. But why would someone in Europe go through the trouble of enameling imported porcelain when Chinese and Japanese imari were readily available in the marketplace? There is no certain or singular answer to this question, but we will ponder a few hypotheses. The first involves capitalistic opportunism. Enamel and gold are affixed to a glazed ceramic body with kiln firing, but at lower temperatures than it takes to fire porcelain and glaze. This means that overglazed decorations are fired at least twice, thus raising the cost of their production. We have records that export porcelains, fashionably enameled in China, were costlier than those without. On the other hand, because enamels are fired at lower temperatures, and possibly in smaller kilns, artisans in the Netherlands, England, France, and Germany realized that they could set up small-scale workshops for enameling at a modest cost. Indeed, as early as the 1680s, advertisements began to appear in Holland for specialized porcelain painters. These tradesmen, and the vendors that worked with them, could make export porcelains tremendously more desirable and expensive at a very low cost. It was almost like alchemy. And doing so would undercut the market for Chinese imari and satisfy a niche clientele with fewer coins to spare. Though we do not have much information on individual artisans, we have a measure of their success in English workshop records from the second half of the 18th century, during which time porcelain painting became organized and industrialized as a practice. Another reason export porcelains were handed over to European enamelers has to do with taste. Some retailers would decide that their stock needed livening up for marketplace appeal. We know that this was especially true of Chinese anhua wares, or ceramics with subtly incised rather than painted decoration. It is likely that anhua was considered too plain or severe for European taste because a good number of examples from England and Holland were enameled with completely discrepant designs. The principle could also apply to our colorful teapot. It could be that the once popular blue and white bird-on-rock teapot fell out of fashion. Perhaps it never managed to fly off the shelf quickly enough, and the vendor decided to update his inventory according to contemporary taste. Or perhaps, after it was purchased, its owner had it enameled for resale or to renew his or her own pleasure in it. Indeed, customers, and not just vendors, would also seek out porcelain painters for a variety of reasons. Perhaps someone had a tea service made up of mismatched pots, cups, and saucers, purchased piecemeal as finances allowed. Adding enamels and gilding to these disparate members was a way to unify them as a set, much like dressing them in a uniform. Consumers might also seek out decorators for customized pieces to commemorate personal or historical events. Because it often took about 2 years to receive a commissioned set from Jingdezhen, factoring in travel time and production time, it makes sense that the impatient consumer might seek to have their wares personalized closer to home. This became such a commonplace request that merchants began specifically to import blank or glazed and undecorated ceramics to then be decorated in Europe. In the absence of other members of a tea service bearing the same enamel patterns as our teapot, and explicit reference to a particular event, we have the least proof that either of these reasons apply to our case. But there is one final explanation for the addition of decoration to this teapot, and it has to do with the social theater around the drinking and serving of tea. Drink cultures throughout Europe dramatically changed between 1500 and the mid-19th century, thanks to the introduction of coffee, chocolate, and tea through mercantile trade. The leafy brew, particularly, became fashionable, though costly, as a centerpiece of social gatherings at home. Because it was so expensive in the late 17th century, tea was brewed only in small quantities, hence the petite stature of our teapots. But that didn't mean that teapots were diminutive objects. The care lavished upon their appearance and display reflected attitudes about the preciousness of their contents. And so, the additional and occasionally redundant enamel decoration could have been desirable because it underscored the luxury status of tea itself and drew attention to the vessel at the center of its consumption. The range of these possible explanations hopes to prove that there is no single absolute reason as to why we have two surviving objects that are so similar and yet so different. In fact, many of the reasons provided above could be complementary to one another, and it is precisely this that makes these objects so valuable for study today. They can tell so many stories. But objects with such complicated hybrid identities have slipped through the cracks of scholarly attention until more recently. In the past, scholars and collectors have come up with several terms to describe Chinese export porcelain such as these, which received additional decorations from European hands, using terms like clobbered or clobberware, over-decorated, or embellished. These phrases are all born of an assumption that what decorations European artisans added worsened or devalued an original object, as though there was an aesthetic or cultural purity to Chinese porcelains that we can recognize and separate from everything else. We now know that many ceramic forms and motifs produced at Jingdezhen were conveyed there by foreign merchants and visitors. Even the iconic cobalt blue that we associate with Ming Dynasty porcelain was originally adapted from its usage in the Middle East. This is not to privilege the influence of any singular source in this production, but to recognize the cosmopolitan world through which these objects moved. And we need only to think of the complex chain of events in which Japan, China, and European nations were influencing one another's use of enamel and gold to realize that purity is a tricky word to use in this conversation. If we can know nothing else with certainty, we can recognize that these teapots invite a kind of meditation on networks of cultural exchange and openness to hybridity.